Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Cecil the Lion, who in life was a favourite fixture in a Zimbabwean wildlife park, and now in death has become the object of international outrage since he was lured out of the park so that a dentist from Minnesota could shoot him with an arrow, then 40 hours later finish him off with a gunshot, then have him skinned and beheaded while trying to destroy the GPS collar that researchers from Oxford University had placed on Cecil. George Whitmire, a professor in Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology, who was chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board to Save the Elephants in Africa, joins us to discuss the effects of poaching and trophy hunting on endangered wildlife populations in Africa. Then we will speak with Daphne Wysham, the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy, who was at the Cathedral Park boat ramp in North Portland, watching Greenpeace activists dangle from the St. John's Bridge across the Willamette River, who, along with Kai activists in kayaks, are blocking the passage of an icebreaker Shell Oil plans to send to the Arctic to help it drill for oil under the Arctic Sea. We will discuss why these activists are risking their lives in taking this stand to say, Shell, no. Then finally, we will examine reports that the Taliban leader Mullah Omar has been dead for 2 years, which calls into question who is speaking for the Taliban in peace talks set to resume on Friday in Pakistan between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Shuja Nawaz, the former director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States, joins us to discuss why Pakistan wants the talks to succeed and whether the parties can find common ground to end decades of ruinous fighting in one of the world's poorest countries. Joining us now is George Whitmire, who is a professor in Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology in the Warner College of Natural Resources. He's also the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa, and he has gained global media attention in recent years and is recognized by the international wildlife community for his in-depth elephant research and scientific documentation on the effects of poaching on wild animal populations. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Whitmire.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly, the story in the news for the last couple of days has been about Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe, who I think is striking a chord with an awful lot of people around the world. Apparently, this was a really magnificent specimen of a male lion, unusually large with a black mane. He apparently took care of two prides of lions, containing six lionesses and 12 cubs, along with another lion called Jericho. And he was a favorite in the wildlife park in Zimbabwe of tourists. And yet he ends up being killed by a dentist from Minnesota. So I don't know. I guess you're familiar with this kind of senseless slaughter in terms of the elephants, but the lions aren't endangered. But this surely doesn't make it any less disgraceful.
Yeah, I think there's a real problem going on in certain countries in Africa with their trophy hunting operations. And so we've heard anecdotes. I think this is probably one of the more high-profile cases, but there's been quite a bit of discussion about this of luring trophy individuals out of protected areas, into a hunting block in order to sort of get the maximum trophy. And I think this is a problem. It really sort of goes against what we think of as of the ethics of hunting, at least in terms of how we perceive it as North Americans and the North American model of hunting, which I would assume this the Minnesota hunter is probably subscribing to and probably to some extent thinks by hunting these animals he's helping their conservation. But yeah, we're seeing real issues with some of the ethics and the management going on. And Zimbabwe's been flagged. It's actually it's been reprimanded, and it's actually undergoing sanctions for elephant hunting. That they're not allowed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has banned trophy imports from Zimbabwe and Tanzania for because of problems with their hunting industry. And the EU, I think, recently banned trophy importation from Mozambique and Zimbabwe as well. So there's recognition that this is a problem, and this is a particularly poignant example of it that's really struck a chord with the public. But it's an issue. We've had a lot of different examples of where hunting can play a really critical role in conservation, even trophy hunting, high value trophy hunting. It certainly can develop important revenue, but it's important that it's adheres to ecological principles and best practices, and that it's scientifically managed in order for it to actually have a positive impact. And this seems to be a case where that was not followed.
But in terms of ethics, I mean, I don't know how it's ethical in any way to shoot a lion, first of all, to lure it out of the game park deliberately, and then to shoot it with a bow and arrow, and it takes 40 hours to die, or actually, I don't know, it was in pain and for 40 hours, and then it apparently was finally tracked down and then shot with a rifle, and then skinned and beheaded. But just in terms of animal conservation, isn't it the way that the lion prides work is that the alpha male has to fight off all of the young males, and then he impregnates all the females based upon the idea of the most powerful gene pool? And now that he's been killed, Cecil, all of the cubs apparently are likely to be killed by the next male lion who shows up to claim the pride.
Yep, that would be the case with lions. So there's actually quite a bit of turnover in lions in terms of males' ability to hold the pride. And there's been people who claim that males of the age of Cecil have typically are past their prime and not able to effectively hold pride. I don't know if that's the case with Cecil or how well documented it was his reproductive state, his ability to hold pride at this stage in his life, but that he was an older male, and it becomes taxing for them to fend off younger competitors. But indeed, once they're displaced or they're killed, and they lose the dominance of their pride, the next male will come in and will, because his tenure duration is so short, they actually can't. They've evolved to not wait for opportunities to breed, but to actually catalyze them through infanticide, as we call it, the killing of the young in the group that are not that were not sired by the male. So that is a practice done by lions. Actually, a number of species do that, and it speaks to really how short their tenure is. That behavior, that practice, has evolved.
Well, you know, nature may seem cruel to some, but I, compared to some dentist from Minnesota using a bow and arrow and a gun on a lion, I mean, it's just that kind of cruelty. I think it's a whole different scale of disgracefulness.
Yeah, well, hunting is definitely a practice that incites a lot of different emotions from different individuals, and there's valid reasons there's valid reasons, conservation reasons, to allow hunting. And it's done important support and across, the example of the North American conservation model, where 100 years ago, most of our species were on the decline and headed towards extinction. And it was really through, it was really hunters that drove a lot of the legislation and the legal framework, which have been so successful in North America to return a lot of our large mammals to population sizes they once were. There's cases where we still have very few individuals of certain species, and there's a lot of debates going on that. But there's tangible examples where hunting has been beneficial to conservation. And certainly in Africa, I guess one of the tricks we're dealing with out there is that we're facing a period of time right now where there's rapid land use change, there's rapid impacts on natural systems, and we really need to have models and reasons to conserve wildlife that can get it to the heart of some of the issues there, and some of those are economic issues. And so hunting has been used as a tool to further conservation goals, to protect lands, to protect wild populations, based on the economic returns through hunting. And this has been particularly successful in Namibia, where they've had they have a pretty well-regulated hunting industry. And from all accounts that we can understand, it's been hugely successful in expanding properties, lands dedicated to wildlife, and increasing wildlife populations. So that would be the best success story we have in Africa, where hunting has really tangibly brought benefits. But we also have examples where hunting is highly corrupt, is mismanaged, is not properly regulated, and it's contributing to the demise of species. So, and that's been called out a lot in Zimbabwe of late as being an example of places where the hunting industry is having is in a real mess. And I think previously, maybe 15 years ago, or actually I don't know exactly how long ago, but the hunting industry in Zimbabwe was thought of also as a real success story. And it's unfortunate that that we're seeing these examples come up showing us that there's some serious problems.
And again, I'm speaking with George Whitmire, who's a professor in Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology in the Warner College of Natural Resources. He's also the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa. He has gained global media attention in recent years and is recognized by the international wildlife community for his in-depth elephant research and scientific documentation on the effects of poaching wild animal populations. But in terms of hunting that's actually useful, I guess I'm not entirely sure why it is that you cull out overpopulations. This particular hunter, Walter Palmer, he apparently, there's pictures of him holding up a dead leopard that he shot earlier and a rhinoceros that he had shot earlier on an earlier occasion. I just don't understand, though, if we have an elephant population in decline at a dangerous level, if we have a rhinoceros population, I think, which is even worse off, and I know that with the lions, they're not that endangered, but also there's not that many of them. You know, there's plenty of things you can shoot here in the United States, like deer, which are a weed species, and, you know, you can get the same kind of thrill, if that's a part of it, of stalking an animal, you know, stalking a deer. I just don't understand why the need to go after these, you know, magnificent creatures that we all, as children, read about in storybooks.
Yeah, I guess one clarification on that is actually lions are doing really poorly. Not surprisingly, as we've seen across the globe, large carnivores who need a large, you know, large space and require large prey tend to come in direct conflict with people and livestock. And so that, you know, we can talk about cases in North America with wolves and some of the struggles we've had on wolf reintroduction, although if you speak to people in Wyoming and Montana, they may disagree and say that there's too many wolves on the landscape now. But that's, I think ecologically we can agree that wolves are certainly nowhere near the densities they once were and performing the ecological function they once did. But, you know, it's similar with lions in Africa. They are a magnificent, wonderful species, highly social, very interesting. But if you're living with them, they're also very dangerous to live with. They're a real problem with your, particularly for those doing livestock, husbandry, raising livestock, because they prey on livestock very efficiently. And so there's often can be a negative perception of local people towards species like that, be that in North America with wolves or in Africa with lions. It's sort of the same case. And so often we're stuck in these situations in the conservation on the ground where we're trying to find mechanisms to create goodwill or acceptance or at least the possibility that we can have these wildlife species continuing on the landscape and not being persecuted. What we did in North America is there was a systematic effort. There remains a systematic effort in some places to remove different carnivore species. And particularly in the past, there was huge effort put to removal of carnivores in across the landscape in North America. And it's really, this was done primarily through poisoning and making these poisons illegal has really limited our ability to control these these native carnivores. And that's, in my mind as an ecologist, that's a good thing. I like seeing ecosystems intact and having the full spectrum of species present. But, you know, in Africa, we're seeing very similar progression across the continent, where there's a lot of people that don't want to live with these large species, and they find the threats to them too expensive to bear, and so they're interested in getting rid of them, and they are slowly. In many places, these species are being removed. And so I understand there's the ethical argument of why do we need to go shoot these endangered species? Why do we have to kill these majestic animals to get a thrill when can't we get it other ways? You know, I certainly can understand that perspective 100%. But I think the other side of this is that oftentimes we're trying to find a solution to keep that species there. That doesn't mean it's okay to bait a prime breeding male lion out of that's well recognized, that's being tracked and studied, and luring that animal out of a protected area to shoot him. That's not the type of hunting I'm speaking to. That would clearly be defined as an unethical hunt across the spectrum. And I suspect that the hunter, the individual that actually did the killing, I hope he was completely ignorant of that behavior, although one wonders when given those circumstances. But certainly I imagine publicly he would deny knowledge of any of these unethical behaviors. The hunting community broadly should be denying that it's okay to hunt species in this manner, of luring, baiting them out of parks to kill trophy individuals. That should be something they're against. I don't know if, you know, it might be interesting to speak to some of these hunting lobby individuals to find that out. Mm-hmm. But I guess what the nuanced argument here is that there are cases where hunting is maybe ethically in some people's mind is not the best approach to use, but it might be the only approach of effect that we have, the only tool we have to keep species on a landscape. And in those cases, I'm in support of using hunting to try to maintain wilderness areas or try to protect populations that are otherwise going to be removed. So that's an unfortunate thing. We can't always have our cake and eat it too, I guess, in this case. And so we got to figure out a practical solution to keep the animals. Again, I just want to clarify that doing sustainable hunting, sustainable harvesting, there's a science to it. There's well developed theory to doing this, and there's ethical guidelines that the hunting community adheres to, supposedly. The problem is that we have many in the hunting community that don't, and so there has to be regulation. There has to be penalization for those that are not subscribing to the legal mandates and the scientific-based information.
Well, in terms of scientific information, this animal, Cecil the lion, was collared by a research team from Oxford University. And after he'd been shot by a bow and arrow and spent 40 hours in agony before they caught up to him and shot him, they tried to. Both this hunter, Walter Palmer, the dentist from Minnesota, along with Theo Brockhorst, who's the sort of professional big game hunter who was paid $50,000, and the farm owner, Honest Delovu, they apparently, or some of them, tried to destroy the GPS collar unsuccessfully. So, I mean, clearly this not only this animal have value to the park and to tourism because he was so popular, but he also must have had some scientific value if they had collared him.
Yeah, certainly, and it's a clear case of these guys. From all the evidence that you're telling me now, and from what I can glean, I'm not on the ground. I don't know the story, but from what you just stated, this is a highly unethical hunt. I'm sure it's illegal in Zimbabwean laws to do that. And essentially they've baited and poached this lion illegally, and they should be held accountable. And from what I understand, the Zimbabwean government has filed charges against those involved in this, because it was illegal. It was an illegal hunt. The manner in which it was conducted was not according to the laws in Zimbabwe, and they're being held accountable for that. And so, yes, in every way, this is a tragedy individually to lose that lion from his, you know, obvious value in many different ways, as you mentioned, from research to the non-consumptive tourism sector. And it's just a tragedy that these individuals are willing to thwart the laws and do this behavior and remove these individuals that shouldn't be. And this, you know, the sad part of this is happening quite regularly. You know, this is an example where we have evidence of it basically due to the radio tracking, from my understanding. But you can imagine how many, we're not able to track, put collars on all individuals in all populations. And so the vast majority of individuals are not radio tracked. You're tracking very few individuals on the landscape. And so these kind of things are happening all the time and no one knows. And it's a real concern. It's a real problem within the hunting sector, particularly these countries that have been flagged as having hunting sectors that are not performing these activities legally. Sanctions have been put in place on some of those countries for certain species, and a response to this that I imagine people will bring up is if we should put sanctions on lion trophy imports to the United States in order to signify that this is unacceptable behavior. I'm not sure that will happen in this case, because I think the Zimbabwean government is also taking this very seriously and is also quite unhappy with how this has happened, and they're apparently holding these individuals to task. But again, yes, I think it's the sad part of this is I think this is happening much more than we realize, and this is an example of a problem that's really endemic in some sectors in the hunting community, and the real thing we need is we need the hunting community themselves to self-regulate and to deal with this problem within their own ranks, and that will be the most effective way, because otherwise we're really not going to get much information on these types of activities. It's just going to be these one-off cases where we happen to have luck of the day, where we happen to have a collar that's functioning on an individual where that this was done. But most of the time, we won't know this is happening. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, just in closing, you work, obviously, you're on the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa, and the elephants are in very endangered. And the president, in his trip to Africa in the last few days, did talk about ivory poaching and made proposals here in the United States to outlaw ivory altogether. But just to touch on what you corrected me on when I suggested that the lion population wasn't quite as endangered, it actually is, as you pointed out. African lion populations have fallen almost 60% over three decades, and there is as few as 32,000 of them in the wild, according to the International Fund for Animal Welfare. So I thank you for joining us, George Whitmire.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with George Whitmire, who's a professor in Colorado State University Department of Fish, Wildlife and Conservation Biology in the Warner College of Natural Resources, and also the chairman of the Scientific Advisory Board of Save the Elephants in Africa. He has gained global media attention in recent years and is recognized by the international wildlife community for his in-depth elephant research and scientific documentation on the effects of poaching wild animal populations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about Kai activists and Greenpeace activists who are blocking the passage of a Shell Oil icebreaker in Portland, Oregon.
What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Portland, Oregon, is Daphne Wysham, who's a climate policy fellow at the Center for Sustainable Economy, where she is leading the center's work with sustainable businesses, community groups, public health officials, and labor leaders in the Pacific Northwest on reversing the climate impacts of deforestation and in transforming the region from a major fossil fuel export economy into a leading clean energy economy with new sustainable metrics to help guide the way. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daphne Wysham.
Thank you for having me.
And from where you are in Portland, I take it you've got a bird's eye view of the bridge over the Willamette River,
from which, that's right. There
are Greenpeace protesters suspended to try and block the passage of a drilling rig, a very unusual ship that Shell Oil has that is an Arctic icebreaker. And they're dangling from the St. John's Bridge, which spans the Willamette River in North Portland. And are there also kayakers in the water? Because they're being referred to as kayaktivists.
Yes. Well, the Climate Action Coalition, which helped pull together the original attempt to blockade the Seneca, which is the Arctic icebreaker that is being repaired here in Portland's dry dock, it gashed its hull by taking a shortcut through a channel that it shouldn't have gone through. And so now it's down here getting its hull repaired and was prepared to return to the Arctic to allow Shell to commence drilling. We would have none of that. So we prepared to do a kayak blockade with over 60 kayakers who took to the water late last night, and we're prepared to stay there all evening because we had heard that the Seneca was due to depart from Portland at 4:30 in the morning. We were pleasantly surprised when Greenpeace activists unfurled their ropes and their banners, and they're now hanging 13 of them suspended from the St. John's Bridge, and they have a rope that is both holding them to the bridge and also connecting each one of them to each other. They have red and yellow banners, the color of Shell Oil's logo, waving in the breeze in the very hot summer sun. It's now in the 90s in this late afternoon here in Portland, and it's a reminder of why we're all here. It's record-breaking temperatures, record-breaking drought, and we've reached a point where people need to take a stand.
So, Daphne Wysham, what is the actual plan, though, to block it? Would these Greenpeace activists dangling from the bridge, would their lives be in danger? Would the kayakers be in danger if this ship just plows ahead? After all, it is an icebreaker.
Yes, the icebreaker is quite large. The Greenpeace activists are suspended in the path of the icebreaker, so were it to proceed, it would run into the ropes that are holding them all together, and they would all be in danger. So essentially, all of these Greenpeace activists have put their lives on the line. We are not clear on how they're going to respond. The police have maintained a hands-off attitude thus far. We're calling on the governor of Oregon, Governor Kate Brown, to ensure that no arrests take place and to allow the nonviolent civil disobedience to continue. We expect quite a few other surprises as the day and evening unfolds. We've heard from quite a few people that they're very eager to join us in civil disobedience.
Well, in Seattle, of course, activists have formed a flotilla of kayaks to demonstrate against Shell as well, including a group called the Raging Grannies, who were arrested after trying to block the entrance of Terminal 5, where the Polar Pioneer was moored. So people are really, putting their lives on the line, as you say.
They are. And the Raging Grannies are actually part of our coalition. They're here as well. And they've been a very valuable ally in this work. We've got folks of all ages, from families showing up with their kids, being prepared to go out on the water, to folks in their late 80s who are prepared to get arrested.
So what do you think Shell, first of all, I think a lot of people were quite alarmed when the Obama administration gave Shell permission to drill in the Arctic. I spoke with a specialist up in Alaska on oil drilling, and particularly under those extraordinary conditions. And if they were able to get oil, strike oil in those straits, which are frozen over at least half of the year, and then for the rest of the year, you pretty much need an icebreaker to get in there. If they were to successfully strike oil, then they would have to build a pipeline not on the surface of the underwater, not on the silt, because apparently when the ice breaks up, it scours the bottom of the ocean. So they have to actually build this pipeline deep underneath the ocean floor, 30 or 40 meters down, for I think about 100 miles or so. The kind of money that they're prepared to spend is extraordinary. And at the same time, we know from what happened in the Gulf of Mexico with the blowout of the BP rig and the damage that that caused, that was bad enough. But if it were to happen up in Alaska, there's absolutely no way it could be mitigated once a catastrophe took place.
Exactly. And, of course, Shell is the second largest corporation in the world. They have one of the reasons they're trying to drill in the Arctic is to maintain their shareholder value. If they can get access to those reserves and show them on their balance sheets, their shareholders will be happy. It's one reason why we're encouraging people to divest from the fossil fuel industry, because it's literally destroying the planet. And the nearest Coast Guard station from this drilling region is 1,000 miles away. I mean, the scale of things up in the Arctic is completely hard for us to comprehend, those of us down in the lower 48, but there just are not the kind of resources, both in terms of spill response, in terms of emergency response. It's a fool's errand. As Al Gore said, it's insane. And fortunately, we have a senator here in Oregon, Senator Merkley, who has put forward a bill to bring an end to all Arctic drilling, and we're encouraging California senators, California's governor, and others around the country to support Senator Merkley's ban on Arctic drilling.
So the importance of this icebreaker is that Shell's got this permit to operate in the Arctic, but until the icebreaker arrives with this key pieces of safety equipment, the company can't drill into the oil-bearing zones, right? That's why.
Well, they have two icebreakers, I'm told. This is one of two. I'm told that they have a key piece of equipment which can help cap a blowout like we saw with the Macondo well in the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, that was a piece of cake compared to a blowout that would take place in the Arctic. And we know how long it took us to cap that well. But one of the pieces of equipment that they need to ensure that a blowout is capped is on board the Finca. And as long as the Finca stays here, we're told they cannot commence drilling.
And given that when the ice breaks up every year, these ice, we know an iceberg is 1/10 above water, 9/10 below water, and apparently they scour the ocean floor. So even if you got a blowout preventer there, I can't imagine how you can reinforce it against nature.
Exactly. I know. It's absurd. It's absurd, and it shows the lengths to which corporations will go to risk our natural environment, our health, in fact, the entire planet's healthy ecosystem for profit. And we cannot tolerate it. Our everybody from our president to our pope, to the pope, has declared this a planetary emergency. We need elected officials to no longer continue with business as usual and to act as though it is, in fact, a planetary emergency. And if they won't, we will. We know that scientists have told us we need to keep 2/3 to 3/4 of all proven reserves of fossil fuels in the ground. These new reserves that Shell wants to open up would expand our existing reserves. We already are pumping out more oil than any country in the world. It's absurd to think that we need to tap into this incredibly dangerous and very sensitive part of the globe.
And again, I'm speaking with Daphne Washam, who's a climate policy fellow at the Center for Sustainable Economy, where she's leading the center's work with sustainable businesses, community groups, public health officials, and labor leaders in the Pacific Northwest on reversing the climate impacts of deforestation and in transforming the region from a major fossil fuel export economy into a leading clean energy economy with new sustainable metrics to help guide the way. And she is at the Cathedral Park Boat Ramp in North Portland, right in front of the St. John's Bridge, which spans the Willamette River in North Portland. And there are Greenpeace activists dangling from the bridge as we speak. And we just don't know when this boat is going to come. But what happens when it does come and endanger the lives of these Greenpeace activists dangling in front of it, as well as the kayakers in the water? Will the police intervene, or what do you think is going to happen?
Well, we know that it's being discussed at the highest levels of state government, and they're trying to determine what action to take. But regardless of what action they take, our coalition has taken a very firm stand against all new fossil fuel infrastructure in the state of Oregon. We've gotten the endorsement of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon on that position. We encourage other groups in California to take on a similar position. The time has come for the fossil fuel age to end. We cannot be building more rigs, more drilling for more oil, more pipelines at a time when we're headed for planetary catastrophe.
And, of course, a part of this in terms of endangering the planet is the Keystone XL pipeline and the protests that have taken place against that. And that raises some real questions. First of all, candidate Hillary Clinton was asked about her position on the Keystone XL pipeline, and she gave a peculiar answer, saying she can't answer that question until she becomes president or, you know, wins, because this is now in Obama's hands. But one of the things that issue raises of the Canadian tar sands being shipped across the United States to the refineries down in the Gulf of Mexico, that can the only ones that can refine this heavy bitumen. At this point, that stuff travels by rail, and there's a growing movement to try and block the passage by rail of this oil because our rail infrastructure is so frail. And you know, there have been a number of accidents, and a whole little town up in Quebec was burned alive from an oil spill. So how do you navigate between the idea that the oil is already coming down across rail and endangering communities, at the same time the Keystone XL pipeline people are arguing that's the very reason why you should build the pipeline, because at the moment it's traveling by rail, which is more dangerous, and if you let us have the pipeline, it's much safer?
Well, first of all, the Keystone XL pipeline, as bad as it is, people need to keep it in perspective. We have five times the carbon content of the Keystone XL pipeline coming through by ship, by rail, by pipeline in the Pacific Northwest. So it's one reason why we've called for no new fossil fuel infrastructure. If the Keystone XL pipeline means game over for the planet, five times that in the form of new fossil fuel infrastructure means game over times five. So, and in terms of, the problem of what we call bomb trains here, they're also proposing bomb ships. We fought and won a proposed propane export terminal that they wanted to build, bringing propane from fracking wells up in Alberta to Portland via rail. And if you can imagine the insanity of that proposal, they were going to bring mile-long trains packed with propane, and propane is the one thing that is causing these bomb trains to explode, because when they take the bitumen out of the ground and the oil out of the ground, propane is the most explosive thing. And they were prepared to bring mile-long trains to Portland. We managed to educate our mayor, who initially supported it, and he came out in opposition to that terminal, and shortly thereafter got a call from the Pope inviting him to share his green credentials with the folks in Rome. So we're hoping that he's seen the light and understands that this is what the people of Portland want for good, not just on occasion. And we're hoping to get a statement from him in support of these protesters out here today. So far, we've heard nothing.
But on the choice between bomb trains carrying tar sands oil to Texas vis-a-vis the argument on the part of the proponents of the Keystone XL pipeline, which is let us build the pipeline because it's unsafe to ship this oil, which is now being shipped by rail.
Well, I mean, that's a false choice. That assumes that we have to take one or the other. And the truth of the matter is that the fossil fuel industry is externalizing enormous costs on all of us, not just climate costs, which Stanford University has calculated at over $200 a ton in terms of the cost that the fossil fuel industry is externalizing on the entire planet, but also the risks of an explosion. Should those explosions occur, I've been in touch with folks at the Department of Transportation, it's going to be the taxpayers that pick up the tab. The BNSF and other rail companies that are shipping this crude around the country do not have adequate insurance to cover the eventuality should, for example, a bomb train explode in downtown Seattle. And in fact, a bomb train has gone off the tracks in downtown Seattle, and fortunately it did not cause any damage, but these kinds of things are happening with far too much regularity. It's estimated that we will be getting 10 derailments of bomb trains per year. This is an unacceptable risk that we accept for whatever reason in cities around the country, and we've got to put a stop to it.
Well, Daphne Wysham, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Daphne Wysham, who's a climate policy fellow at the Center for Sustainable Economy, where she is leading the center's work with sustainable businesses, community groups, public health officials, and labor leaders in the Pacific Northwest on reversing the climate impacts of deforestation and in transforming the region from a major fossil fuel export economy into a leading clean energy economy with new sustainable metrics to help guide the way. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining reports that the Taliban leader Mullah Omar has been dead for 2 years.
Now the deep water horizon descends down to the death storm, and at the bird's foot, they've lost a home. Cause all the leaves are drifting for miles and miles.
دو چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنین نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی بچند.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. Shuja Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was formerly the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian.
And the news that the Afghan government is confirming that there's credible information indicating that Taliban leader Mullah Omar died in April of 2013 in Pakistan, although the Pakistani authorities have, or the Pakistan's foreign ministry said it had no information about the announcement, the White House is saying that reports of Mullah Omar's death are credible. What's your sense? I mean, it sounds as if it's actually true, right?
It's quite possible, but the Pakistani Foreign Office obviously would not be the first to confirm or deny it. It is really the Inter-Services Intelligence of Pakistan that would have a much better sense of what is correct and what's not correct. And so we should wait for the official Pakistani reaction. Obviously, according to the Afghan information, the early information, they are alleging that he died in a hospital near Karachi inside Pakistan. According to some other reports, he was buried on the Afghan side of the border. So it's unclear who is speaking for the Afghan Taliban at the moment.
But if it's true that he died about 2 years ago, surely the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI, since he's been in Pakistan all these years, they must watch him closely. It's extraordinary that they have been so silent for so long.
Well, we're not quite sure of the facts of this, whether they were able to track him and watch him carefully or whether they were dealing with people who spoke for him. None of that has yet been established beyond doubt. Clearly, if the Pakistanis were aware of the fact that he was ill and that the fact that he died and they didn't share it with anyone, then they will have some explaining to do to their allies, as well as to the people of Pakistan. But we don't know at this point.
But if he did, in fact, die of tuberculosis in a hospital in Karachi and was buried near the border on the Afghan side, and clearly Pakistan is watching these talks that are underway. After all, the talks are happening in Pakistan itself. The second round of the peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban are due to be held on Friday. And again, if they're involved in the peace talks, they must be aware of who's speaking for whom. And I guess that's really the big question, apart from the mystery surrounding Mullah Omar's death, is who's representing the Taliban at these talks? And if Mullah Omar has been dead all this time, have they been pretending he's alive? I believe one of the factions within the Taliban wanted Mullah Omar's son to replace him. And apparently the political leader of the Taliban, Akhtar Mohammad Mansour, is speaking for them, and he apparently supports these peace talks. So what's your sense then, Shuja Nawaz, of who's in charge here? Who are the Afghan government dealing with, and do they speak for the Taliban?
I think this is probably going to be item number one when they meet again on Friday. The Afghans most certainly would want to know, are we dealing with the right people? And we'll also want corroboration of the reports that have emanated from Afghanistan that he, in fact, died 2 years ago. It's not just Mansour or speculation about Mullah Omar's son. That's not a name that has figured earlier on in terms of the leadership of the Afghan Quetta Shura, as it was called. Another name that came up was that of Mullah Baradar, who at one time was seen as a potential interlocutor between Mullah Omar and the Afghan government, and then was picked up in Karachi by the Pakistani intelligence and has been under their custody except for a very brief encounter with the Afghan High Peace Council, who found him apparently not fully in his senses when they met him in Peshawar. So there's still a lot of questions that will probably be answered behind closed doors on Friday, and we hope after that, either directly or through leaks, we will find out exactly what happened and when and who was aware of it. The critical thing in all of this, Ian, is that both Pakistan and Afghanistan are very heavily invested in this peace process, in the reconciliation process. And Pakistan, on its part, will need to deliver some kind of a settlement or reconciliation process, which will allow the Afghan government to consummate it at its pace and to its liking. And then Pakistan will have done its duty to its neighboring state. If the process falls apart, or if they don't know who they're talking to, or the credibility of the interlocutors is questioned, then this will be a setback.
And again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was formerly the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. So in terms of, you just mentioned that Pakistan has invested in these peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. I take it that one of the motives on the part of Pakistan is that they already have their hands full with the Pakistan Taliban, who have caused enormous trouble within the country. And the idea of the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban getting together is a nightmare scenario for the Pakistanis. So they don't want to have a reverse sanctuary situation where Taliban can strike inside Pakistan and retreat back into Afghanistan if Afghanistan ends up in the hands of the Taliban. So in a curious way, from what my understanding is, that after having supported the Afghan Taliban all these years, the Pakistan military and government are now sort of having buyer's remorse.
Absolutely. And I think they came to this conclusion and this understanding, and it concentrated their minds once the reverse sanctuary became a reality in the Kunar province, where the people that they had chased out of Swat and Malakand had found refuge. But this could happen anywhere across the Afghan-Pakistan border. And they don't want to be stationing 180,000-plus troops on that border when they are looking over their shoulders to the east towards India. So this is something that the Pakistan military and the civilian government both are heavily invested in. The Prime Minister has taken a strong personal interest in it. He is trying to match the confidence that has been invested in this process by the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani. And now the question is, you know, whether he'll be able to deliver and build up the confidence between Afghanistan and Pakistan so that they can then proceed to other things such as economic relationships and pipelines from Central Asia into Afghanistan and Pakistan.
But I take it there's some considerable ill will between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, there has been tremendous suspicion because of this issue of support for part of the Afghan Taliban. I think that suspicion has to be overcome if this relationship is to proceed in a positive trajectory. But that's why the fact that the Pakistan Army Chief and the head of the ISI, as well as the Pakistan Prime Minister, have made a number of trips to Kabul, and the Afghan president has come to Islamabad. I think that dialogue has to proceed and will probably continue. It's not going to be a sprint. I think this is going to be a bit of a marathon for them. But it's critical that they show some signs of progress in order to protect themselves against the critics at home in both Kabul as well as Islamabad.
And meanwhile, on the ground in Afghanistan, the Taliban are seizing territory in three provinces in the northern Afghanistan. Just in recent days, they've had some considerable success in Kunduz and threatening the city itself, which is on the border with Tajikistan. I think that was the area, Kunduz province was the area that the Australians were assigned to, but they've, along with NATO, have withdrawn now. So this leads, you know, the broader question is, while talks are underway, it does look as if the Taliban are making a maximum military effort on the ground and meeting with enormous success. I mean, they just captured hundreds of Afghan police surrounded, 110 in fact, surrendered to the Taliban at a base in the northeast that was under attack just recently. So I suppose it, in these kind of negotiations, it's not surprising that you try to make as much military gains on the ground as you can because it gives you bargaining leverage. But is there a possibility that the Afghan army itself and its police are something of a paper tiger and could collapse? What's your sense of that, Shuja?
Well, I think for the time being, with the presence of coalition forces there till the end of the year, it's going to be difficult to see the Afghan national security forces collapsing, clearly the much discussed and much heralded training program that built up a big Afghan army has really not produced an effective fighting force of very large numbers. But the Afghans have shown some success in small encounters at the tactical level. I think at the strategic level, the Afghan leadership could probably win a victory of sorts by working out some kind of a modus vivendi with the Taliban leadership so that they can isolate these regional operations in some way and cut them off from their source of support, which is going to be from the Kandahar area and then the border with Pakistani Balochistan.
So what's going to happen then to the Haqqani network, who've proven to be a really tough enemy of the U.S. and NATO?
Well, the Haqqani network remains in place. Their home base, which was North Waziristan, has been cleared by the Pakistan military. So clearly, if they're going to continue their operations, they will have to do so from inside Afghanistan or along the rugged border with Quorum Agency or Orakzai. The Pakistanis did successfully have a clearing operation in the Khyber Agency, which was another place where people were collecting. I think this is going to go on. It's going to be a fluid situation probably for the next 6 months to a year as the Pakistanis realize that you really cannot seal the border perfectly. But with their storehouses, with their training grounds, with their headquarters disrupted in North Waziristan, I think the Haqqanis are going to find it harder to coordinate and to launch the kind of attacks that they once were launching inside Afghanistan.
But just in closing, I guess the fact that the Afghan government and the Taliban are talking and apparently even could make a deal, that's something new and I guess hopeful.
Absolutely. And I think on that, President Ghani deserves a lot of credit. It was a risky venture for him to proceed along this path. Even riskier was to work things out with Pakistan to the extent that the Pakistanis are playing apparently a reasonably positive role in this process. Now the results will have to be awaited to see, you know, how this will all come out. I think for stability in the region as a whole, not just in Afghanistan, it's critical that there be reconciliation inside Afghanistan.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Shuja Nawaz.
As always, Ian, a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was formerly the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.